Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 20th. I'm Ray Graff. Baseball is closing in on the halfway point of a somewhat surreal 60-game season. Hockey and basketball are holding their playoffs in a bubble. The NFL begins in just a few weeks, but college sports remain in flux. Whether or not there are fans in the stands, our experts are on the line, ready to talk sports. WAMC commentators Keith Strudler and Jane McManus are ready to let us pick their brains. If you have a sports question or comment, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The number again is 800-348-2551. Keith Strudler, Jane McManus, your sports calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk sports today, and it's a little different than the usual sports talk we do on this show every 6 months or 8 months. Things are a little odd. The NBA, the NHL playoffs, they're going. Baseball is going. The giants of college athletics moving ahead despite the COVID-19 threat. Why? Well, here's a hint. It rhymes with funny. Here's to discuss all of this and much more. We have two of our favorite WAMC commentators, Keith Strudler, Director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University, and Jane McManus, Director of the Center for Sports Communication at Marist College, also a columnist for the New York Daily News. If you got a sports question or comment, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Jane McManus, Keith Strudler, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Jane, great to talk with you.
I know. This is exciting, Keith, just for you and I, not even counting the audience.
Right.
I didn't even know this was going to be on the air. I just assumed this was a Zoom meeting. It's a pleasure to talk to the listeners as well.
Jane hasn't done this before, so we're assuming there is an audience. So we'll find out soon enough. The number here is 800-348-2551. Jane, you spent a long time as a reporter. You still write for the Daily News. You were with ESPN. Have you ever seen a sports landscape like it is right here on the 20th of August?
Well, of course not. I don't think any of us have, at least, you know, not since, 1918 when hockey had to cancel the Stanley Cup for the pandemic of that year. It's completely unusual. And to me, this is exactly case in point why we have students and we try to kind of instill them with some journalism instincts because, you know, this isn't necessarily a sports story 100%. This is a story where you really have to be nimble and you have to learn about a lot of things outside of sports to kind of get a handle on what's actually happening.
You know, I look at this in two ways. And Keith, I'll throw this to you first and then we'll bat it around a little bit. There are two ways to look at the way sports have unraveled here. Some are keeping going. And one is it's given us a chance to prioritize. One, in the grand scheme of everyday life, sports, not that important, right? It's living. It's getting through the day, being healthy, being with your family, being with those you love. But on the other hand, from a societal standpoint, there is something so deeply important to many of us and about the normalcy that just turning on the TV and watching sports provides.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly why this is so complicated. And we often find ourselves living in these moments of dissonance where, on the one hand, we really want to see sports. On the other hand, we're not sure that's necessarily the best thing to do. So, I have said all along that, you know, in many cases, we're about seeing college sports. It looks like it's kind of time to shut the thing down, unless you're at the University of Tennessee when you're like, well, as long as we only have a quarter density in the football stadium, we're fine. It may not happen for college sports. As a former college athlete, I know how difficult that is, and it shouldn't be taken lightly. I do think if there's a way to safely keep professional sports moving forward, I do believe that it is a good thing for the country. Again, that's the giant caveat, if there's a way to do this safely, and I think there's value to that. That said, I think that the real story for people like myself, and I'm sure Jane could speak to this as well, you know, it's not just the story of the NFL and elite sports and, you know, those kind of pastimes. It's the everyday part of your life where your kids play on soccer clubs and little league baseball teams and softball teams and gymnastics. And those become really difficult questions about the kind of risk that you want to take personally with your family and the kind of risk that your community wants to take, in many cases without necessarily the benefit of the best medical knowledge, and certainly not with the kind of foresight that you need to know how risky something really is. But, you know, if you sit at home with your kids for long enough, you start to feel what they're missing when they're not participating in those kind of social activities. So in some ways, this entire medical and social experiment is reminding us of some of the most core elemental reasons that sport matters to us kind of as individuals and as a public. And, you know, we're grappling with that as we go through, and probably on the other end of this crisis, and I do believe there will be another end of this crisis, in addition to how all of the world is going to change, including certainly how sports are broadcast and which sports are broadcast and how they're broadcast. But I think sport's going to look a whole lot different. And that's, you know, there'll be some good that comes out of that.
We're talking sports today with Keith Strudler and Jane McManus. Jane, you were at ESPN. You're not there anymore, right?
No.
Okay.
No. I worked there until 2017. I covered the Jets and was an NFL analyst.
You know, watching baseball, and I'm a big Mets fan, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, and it has been wonderful for me. You know, I worked straight through the pandemic, and we came to work every day, and we were here, and it was scary many times. And there, even though the season was delayed, even though there are cardboard cutouts of fans, and even though the audience sounds are fake, there is a certain just satisfaction to sitting down and watching that game. And it occurs to me, and you being at ESPN might know this a little better, boy, there's a hell of a lot of aspect of showbiz to this.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, Sports and Entertainment Network is what ESPN is all about. I get that, and I get why, you know, it's kind of jarring to watch the NBA when you're seeing digital screens behind the benches and everybody's socially distanced on the sideline. But I'd just like to get back to what Keith said for a second with it being about actually getting us all to playing again. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but the reason I'm interested in sports is because I played sports. And, you know, I played a lot of pickup basketball growing up, something that's not happening right now. And I played roller derby for 7 years, again, something that's not happening right now. But I've been in touch with my old roller derby league, Women's Flat Track Derby Association, and they have really struggled to try to figure out a plan to return to play that includes every single state in this country and, you know, I think 20 or 30 countries abroad as well, and to try to find a mathematical formula that has to do with the virus rate in the community that would tell you what stage it is that you can come back to play, whether it's a non-contact version or if it's full contact with pads. And to me, like, that's what is so interesting about watching the different leagues try to grapple with this, and it seems like the successful leagues are the ones that are doing the heavy-duty testings and pouring a lot of resources into monitoring and testing, whereas, you know, as a society, you look around and we're just not doing that. And so it's kind of a bit jarring to see how successful the NBA and the WNBA have been able to be in the bubble in the wobble, and yet to see that we're not actually mirroring that in our own daily lives.
Let's take a break here. We're talking sports today with Keith Strudler and Jane McManus. You got a comment? You got a question? Give us a call. We'll get to the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we will be right back. It's Vox Pop today. Sports, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Ray Graff with you, and we are joined today by Jane McManus and Keith Strudler. Oh, some fan mail here. You want to hear this, Keith? This is from Laura.
Oh, please. Like, yes, I'm prepared.
No question, just a comment from Laura. She says, I taught a high school sports marketing class and used much of Keith's commentary on WAMC as a jumping off point for many interesting debates and conversations with my students. I don't think any of my students had heard of sports journalism as a career, so that was cool too. Thanks for the commentary. Isn't that nice?
Oh my God. Well, Laura, I value your contributions, to be honest, that's fantastic. Jane, you may know, I started my working career as a junior high school teacher, and I have the utmost in respect for the work that teachers do, trying to again help us feel somewhat normal again, and you know, make these kids kind of, you know, try to focus on what we'd like for kids to be able to focus on as opposed to what they're focused on right now.
You
that's
know,
great.
I know both.
I feel good now.
Well, that's good. I'm sure that'll change by the end of the program.
This is a therapy session. You guys take insurance, correct?
Sure we do. Keith Strudler and Jane McManus join us today. And, you know, you both have opined about the COVID outbreak and how it has affected sports. But the money aspect now, we saw out of the Washington Post yesterday, Big Ten, Pac-12, they are not playing college football this fall. The spring is in jeopardy. Many of the other, I think maybe half of the FBS teams will not play. And that's probably that number will go up. The effect on the bottom line of these colleges, I think the University of Wisconsin was talking about a $100 million hit. That affects more than just sports, right, Jane?
You know, sure, because they've set it up that way. I mean, for a long time, you know, college sports have been taking advantage, I think, of the amateur system in order to make money off of athletes that aren't paid. That's not to say there's not a value in a college education. Obviously, Keith and I believe pretty strongly in the value of a college education, or we wouldn't be doing what we're doing. But it's not the same thing as being paid. It's not currency. It's not something that you can use for a down payment on a car or put aside for future medical expenses in this case. And you have a number of players who have already been diagnosed with myocarditis just today. You have a Georgia State freshman quarterback Michele Colasurdo, who's going to be out for the season because he's got myocarditis. And there was an Indiana defensive lineman, Brady Feeney, who also has the condition. And, you know, when you have the raw numbers of players who have become infected with this during the course of those spring workouts, and we're talking hundreds of players, and not every college is disclosing how many players are infected, you're going to have players who aren't fine, who do have some sort of condition. And I think as a result of that, you know, you're talking about an economic question, but I think there's a real moral question, which is, do you risk these quote-unquote amateur players' health for the financial health of an institution? And if you've set it up so that the institution is dependent on these students and what they're able to produce on a field or on a court, you know, that says a lot. And then also, you know, if you're talking about the value of playing, you know, the NCAA has canceled sports, all of the other sports. So anything else that we'll be playing in the spring is not playing anymore. It's just the question of college football, which I think just lays bare so clearly. I mean, the value of sports is there for all of the athletes, right? Not just the college football players. And yet, when you talk about the arguments of, oh, well, they're better off playing or better off on a college campus than they would be at home, we're only applying that to the football players. And so I think it's a very nakedly economic system. And I think, you know, does that fit in to a college campus and to the mission of an educational system in the same way, you know, that all of its other component parts do? And I don't think it does. I think it's been taken out and it's been changed. And I think that's a bigger, you know, you could make the argument that if professional players want to risk these conditions like myocarditis or having a worse case of COVID than others, you know, that's something that they do in conjunction with their agents and their families and as adults who are making money. It's a different question that we're posing to these college players. And it's not a pure choice in the sense risk and reward that it is for professional players.
Keith Strudler.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, I think what the crisis is going to do, not just in college sports, but in virtually every industry, is expose the frailty of its economic model. I think one of the things that the NCAA has struggled with mightily over the past several years is the growing dichotomy between kind of the Power Five conference schools that really do operate much like a professional franchises that you know kind of use the brand of the university as the name versus you know all of the rest of the schools that kind of play under that same umbrella of Division I athletics. I'm guessing that this is going to precipitate an increased divide between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, you can see that already between the schools that are continuing, you know, I mean, it wasn't a big decision. It wasn't a tough decision for the MAC, for the MAC to say, you know, we're not going to be able to do this because there was no economic pathway forward. You know, when UConn said we're not playing football anymore, the only word they probably left out of that was ever. So because I don't know that something like that has an economic path forward. So I would guess that part of what we're going to see come out of this might be a complete reformation. And this is just, you know, not even considering the fact that if the NCAA basketball tournament doesn't play in the spring, we probably will not see college sports look anything like it looked like before, because the entire economic model of the you know Indianapolis NCAA headquarters is going to fall apart, and they won't be able to pay a light bill. So, as nor will the vast majority of Division I smaller conferences that rely on that shared revenue. So there's going to be some seismic shifts that come with this. So the economics will be laid bare. I do think that big-time college sports, you know, the football and basketball out of the Power Five conferences, will come back a year from now and probably look something like what we used to see before. I don't know that's going to be true for the rest of the universities. There is one question that's going to be kind of adjudicated throughout this process, and it is this question of unpaid labor, which, I mean, that's been a recurrent theme for you know since the beginning of time, and certainly college sports, and it's become more pronounced as these programs generate more revenue and are more professionalized. The challenge will be, and while I think most people, and I know you know Jane and I would probably agree that this does very much resemble professional work. They're working 40 plus hours a week. You know, in no way does it resemble the life of a college student. The challenge still will be the economics will be challenging coming out of this. The challenge will be that I still do not believe that in general, and the polling, you know, seems to be consistent on this over time, in general still doesn't support, you know, paying large or even considerable or even relatively small salaries to college athletes. And in the wake of what's happening, while some athletes are opting out, we're seeing, a quarterback at Ohio State and other athletes, quarterback at Clemson, saying, hey, we want to play. And so there is this odd symbiosis that still exists between big-time college athletes and the universities that do not pay them. And so I don't know, and I think a lot of people have thought that this might be the moment that in the wake of it there'll be a real strong unionization effort and college athletes will be compensated on the back end of this crisis. I don't think that's likely to happen, but I do think the entirety of NCAA Division I sports is going to look very different 2 years from now.
It's Sports Today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. Jane McManus is here and Keith Strudler as well. Let's go to Chris in South Hadley. Chris, you're on.
Hey, guys. How we doing today? Hope everyone's doing well. So you guys have touched on it quite a bit already, but, you know, just this national conversation, it feels like we've been having since the beginning of time, like Keith alluded to, around paying these NCAA athletes. You know, I'm just wondering your take on it. Do you feel like this is going to be this COVID crisis that is just more of an excuse for these institutions to lean on and say, we're in dire straits, we can't do this? Or, you know, like you've been alluding to, does this really point to how valuable these athletes are and how this doesn't work without them? So getting your take on that, but also just wanted to point out too, is it really any surprise that it's so tough to make these decisions based on medicine and science for an organization like the NFL when we saw how long it took to get on the right side of the concussion protocol stuff?
All right,
I'll let you guys run with that.
Yeah, that's two things. Jane, you go first.
Yeah, I think you raise an interesting point. The NCAA isn't even in charge of college football, which is part of the issue that we've seen playing out right now. The conferences are really in charge of their own destinies there. But I think there's a third path, and I think we've already seen it emerging from state legislatures, which are voting for players to be able to make money off of their names and likenesses, names, image, and likenesses. You've seen a lot of probably stories about NIL. Well, that's what that means, is that it's a way for example, I believe Nebraska just voted that forward, and they're waiting on the governor to sign a bill that would allow Nebraska athletes. And it's one of those things where it's an arms race. If Nebraska and California are letting you do it, but Iowa's not, well, then there's a clear competitive advantage for the schools in those states. So I think you're going to see a third path emerge, which is where student athletes, quote unquote, will be able to earn money, but just not from necessarily their colleges. I mean, keep in mind that these colleges are already in an arms race with money. It's just being spent on facilities and campuses and coaching salaries, you know, which are $6 million, $7 million, $9 million a year, which is outrageous. I mean, it's outrageous that you have that kind of a disparity when it comes to what the coaching staff gets and then what the players actually get. So I think that's part of what's going to happen. But it's clearly, it's a completely system that's been built up with this idea of amateurism and has turned into something that's completely the opposite of that. And I do think you're going to see people start to creatively think. You know, we've seen the Pac-12, the players in the Pac-12 talk about something that's a bit of a quasi-union. And I think you've seen, certainly at least in that area of the country, where there are people who are pretty amenable to that idea and to what that might mean.
Keith.
Yeah, I agree with Jane. I think that universities will, working with state legislatures, find a way to make name and likeness the way that athletes can essentially use the free market to generate revenue. And it does keep the universities out of kind of engaging in what they don't want to do, which is this employee-employer relationship, because that's really the place that they'd like to stay away from for a long litany of reasons. I also think, you know, we need to see what this crisis does to the economics of American colleges and universities. I mean, I worked at a university for over 20 years, and, you know, I'm a school administrator, and, you know, we kind of deal with budgets, and it's going to be challenging depending on how state legislatures react, how families react, how the economy is. There are going to be universities that are going to be hurting for money. I'm certain, you know, well, they already are, and the cuts are pronounced in a lot of places. I think there's going to be a lot of hurry up and wait and see what happens to a lot of athletics departments. We've already seen cuts fairly widespread, generally speaking, in non-revenue sports. As a big fan of the non-revenue sports and the former non-revenue, the most, I believe cross-country produces the least revenue of all sports. So I think you're going to see a lot of cuts. So, you know, who knows? I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of extra dollars available in athletic departments over the next, you know, 12, 24 months. And I think we'll probably see fewer sports engaging in fewer numbers of sports, too.
It is Sports Today with Jane McManus on Keith Strudler. The number is 800-348-2551 on Vox Pop. Marta is in Poughkeepsie. Marta, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thank you. Your guests are very thoughtful, and I've been enjoying listening to
their
impressions as well as their educated knowledge like this. You know, I had Bangers Club, which is what we should call football, that chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But I wanted to ask their opinion on why do you think New York Liberty is at the bottom of the pile in the WNBA? And I mean, I think New York's taken a heavy blow for sure with COVID, so that could be part of it. And also want to mention that sports, the big thing, I read the sports pages every day, Black Lives Matter issue, the systemic racism coming out now at pro level all the way through down to the lowest levels of sports. I am very impressed with the discussion that's taking place. And as far as economizing everything, however you say that word, our whole societal structure needs to change. Why is somebody worth $6 million and somebody isn't worth 2 cents in this society? We definitely need basic universal income. Thanks for letting me rave.
Wow.
Ray.
That's a lot to unpack, Marta, but thank you very much. Jane, do you want
to
comment?
I'd like to address the universal income question first.
All right. Okay. Now let Jane go first, and then you go ahead, Keith. Thanks, Marta.
I think, first of all, you bring up the WNBA, and I think there obviously is a place where they've been on the vanguard of the Black Lives Matter conversation as you know, some of the first players to consistently kneel. Certainly, those players are in constant dialogue with that league and seem to be working in conjunction to get that discussion going. And you see what happened with the Atlanta Dream with their owner, Kelly Loeffler, who's a senator who came out against the Black Lives Matter movement. And then the players on that team the next day came into practice wearing T-shirts that were in support of her senatorial opponent. So you want to talk about a level of activism that could actually, you know, potentially come back to bite them, at least in the paycheck. They were not afraid, those players, to wear that T-shirt. So certainly I think there's a lot of bravery and a lot of outspokenness among WNBA players, and they don't always necessarily get the credit that they deserve. I think there's an interesting thing happening with the Liberty and with they're 1-5, I think, when it comes to on the road, quote unquote road, which is a different animal now that they're all actually playing, you know, at that IMG facility in Florida. You don't actually have road games in the traditional sense. You're not packing your bags, going into a hotel, you know, or eating on the road or anything like that. And yet there's still an incredible home court advantage. And I think that there people are kind of wrestling with that. That's happening in the NBA as well. But, you know, that's certainly one of the things that I've been paying attention to when I look at what's happening in the quote-unquote bubbles, is just what does playing in a bubble and what kind of effect does that have on teams?
Keith.
Yeah, my favorite part of the bubble, of course, was that the better teams were able to play their way into the better hotels. I thought that was a nice way to kind of turn it into something of a survivor as well. And I happen to think, and I'll address the questions in a sec, but I happen to think that this whole movement, you know, having these teams play in this kind of, not necessarily quarantine, but this kind of very intense together environment makes for fantastic television. And I'm not so sure that these things that we're doing now, having all these players together, kind of forming a community, playing these tournaments, I'm not so sure that I don't enjoy it in some ways more than the kind of, you know, the intensity of this, or the, you know, the Broadway show that is the arena now for a television broadcast. I really enjoy watching the kind of sport that we're seeing right now, to the extent that I've been able to watch it. In terms of activism in pro and college sports, I mean, look, athletes, particularly NBA, WNBA, have been leaders in this space for quite some time. And I think you have to credit the players, certainly, who have, you know, kind of made this, you know, I think when the NBA and WNBA, when they said, we want to play, but this has to be part of what we're doing. We're not going to go away at this moment and play sports and not address, you know, one of two most important crises that's happening in this country. And so I think what will be interesting and is most important is to see what kind of policies and progress come out of this moment. You know, will we start to see more aggressive minority hiring practices in college sports and in some pro sports that don't necessarily have that history? You know, will there be Rooney Rule, you know, kind of policies enacted certainly in college football? And so I think it'll be interesting not only to see or to watch the kind of the messages from professional athletes, and certainly professional athletes have very much, you know, kind of developed their voice. But I think it'll be really interesting to see how this affects the way that these front offices operate.
Let's take a quick break here. Keith Strudler is director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. Jane McManus is director of the Center for Sports Communication at Marist College. It's Sports Today, 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Sports Today with Jane McManus and Keith Strudler. The number's 800-348-2551. A couple of emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one came in from, I'm not sure, doesn't have a name on it, writes, with sports in the U.S. under the COVID cloud, is now the time for international soccer to get a bigger foothold in our country? Well, Keith, you got to be all over that one, man.
I'm all in on this. I first of all, I've watched a ton of soccer. Sometimes I'm not even sure what I'm watching, but I'm loving it. And I love the MLS. So I think the answer, it's not just the fact that our country seems to be the only one that can't figure out how to function, and so our sports are inherently behind the rest of the civilized world. And so, yes, we are going to be watching a lot more European sport, including soccer and the Tour de France, which I'm very excited about. But I do think, look, the moment has been coming for quite some time in an increasing multi-ethnic, multicultural, multiracial society that the U.S. is, with the access that young folks have to media streams from all across the world. Soccer's moment in international soccer has been here for some time, and I think this will be just yet another step in the right direction.
With all due respect, folks have been saying that for 45 years.
I understand that, but they haven't seen my 10-year-old play.
There you go. Jane.
Well, the other thing is you have so many, I mean, I deal with young people on a daily basis, and so does Keith. They all have a favorite team. I mean, that's the thing, is that they're all completely invested in this and know what's going on. They're just going to be aging into their buying power. I think it's happening right now as we talk.
This one came in from Jill in Albany. Jill writes, "I'm a sports enthusiast. That said, I've heard that the pro sports players, specifically in the NBA, are being tested for COVID on a fairly regular basis. I do not begrudge the players being tested, but the fact that there are many in the general public who can't get tested and want to be strikes me as very unfair. I work side by side with colleagues who perform the test on the COVID sample 6 days a week. We can't even get tested unless we already have symptoms. This feels like the elite are getting preferential treatment over the common man. Money talks, he who has the gold." And Jill would like some comments on that. Jane, you go first.
Well, Jill is absolutely right, but I would say don't blame the NBA players. Blame the federal government, who cannot seem to get this testing thing figured out. It's not that the NBA players are getting a level of care that no one else should get. It's quite the opposite. They're getting what should be the standard of care for people who are going back to schools and who are going to hospitals to work. This is the kind of thing that we should be doing. And as a matter of fact, the NBA has shown that this works. Like, they are able, they haven't had any positive tests in the bubble or the wobble since the thing opened up, essentially, for all practical purposes. And they're able to play a full contact sport in an indoor setting without transmitting the virus right now. And I think that's where we all want to be, isn't it? So my thinking on that is that we should all have access to testing like that. Now, what the NBA has done is that they've partnered with a laboratory, and they feel fairly certain that the amount of tests that they are having every day isn't taking away from that laboratory's ability to do larger, big picture tests. It's a private lab. It's not taking away from, for example, a state's ability to provide a test. And a lot of testing is provided at the state level. So there's a difference between, because everything is so decentralized in the United States when it comes to testing, there are public and private labs that are involved in reading tests. And a lot of the backlog is because the labs that the public gets access to are backlogged because they don't have enough resources that way. So the NBA is using the resources to get the testing, and it's really what should be the model for everybody else. We should all be looking at the NBA and saying, how do we copy that in our own school system so that we can all get back to doing the things that we like to do?
You know, I don't follow the NHL playoffs this year. As a Ranger fan, I rarely follow professional hockey at all. But they've done very well as far as the COVID goes. And how are those playoffs faring, Keith?
So to be fair, I haven't watched a whole ton of NHL playoffs at this point, but I will tell you, this is the smartest thing that anyone can do in America if they want to stay safe from the disease and play sports safely, and that is they got out of the United States and they went to Canada. And so that was their first very good move. But by all accounts, and Jane, I'm sure, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the NHL. I'm more focused on math placement tests for eighth grade, but the which is equally daunting, by the way.
Yeah.
There is a difference between volume and surface area, and we all need to note that. So, it does seem as though the NHL has done quite a good job. It's tough for the NHL to get traction right now, and the big story is basketball right now, and you know, the 800-pound gorilla is what's going to happen to the NFL. So I don't know that the NHL has necessarily gotten the attention. I'm sure they're loyal, like the NHL always is. You know, the NHL is a live sports league, and it's probably what most of their fans would argue it's the best in-person sports experience in the country. You know, you take that away, and that's a little bit different than a sport like certainly football or basketball, which very much is produced for television at this point. So, but they have, you know, the way they've operated it, by all accounts, seems to be very smart.
You know, you get back to my point about baseball being essentially showbiz at this point with the fake fans and the fake audience noises and sound effects, etc. Baseball and football, to me, for most of us, it's a TV sport only. I mean, cost prohibitive for many. It's often a long drive for many. Many people never go to a live game. And the NHL, I mean, the NFL... We just saw today, I believe, maybe yesterday, Patriots said, hey, at least the first few games, there will be no fans in the stands. Does it really matter at this point from a TV standpoint, Jane McManus?
Well, I think you have to look at how are these leagues making their money, and the NFL makes the majority of its money, or in a traditional year, let's say. The NFL makes the majority of its money off of broadcast, even though they are able to fill the stands, well, for the most part. except for some select venues, but they're able to fill the stands for the most part, but still they're getting most of their money from the broadcast deal and fantasy sports and gambling and all of these other things that kind of rotate around the NFL orbit. But you look at, actually, MLB, 40% of its revenue was generated by gate and in previous years. And that's a big chunk, you know, that's a big chunk. So not being able to have fans is actually quite detrimental. Now, I think, you know, with the emphasis, with them being able to play, you know, with the emphasis being on the broadcast product right now, I don't wonder if that's changed. I'm very interested to see what the numbers are when it comes to advertising on live sports these days. I'll bet they're pretty high. And I wonder what they are compared then to a normal year. You might find more interest now just because the idea of sports being back, they're in such short supply that for Major League Baseball, they get back early. I don't know what that did necessarily to the bottom line, but I bet it's definitely different than it is in a normal year. And that's the balance, right? The thing is, it's not responsible. This is what gets me about college sports also. When they're like, we're only going to have 7/8 of the fans in the arena. It just goes to show you that they're not actually looking at what's safest for the fans. And then you have to extrapolate and say they're probably not doing what's safest for the players. They're doing what's best for the bottom line. And right now, it's not responsible to have any fans.
Well, that's what the Patriots, in fact, ended up with. They said, listen, we'll go with 25% in the stands, and the NFL and the other owners, and it was decided, no, you will not, to start. And so it seems like they have done the right thing, right?
Well, you know, you could also make the argument, certainly the NFL, the worst thing that they could have happen is to have the organization turn into the Marlins, and so where they get, you know, a foot out the door and then they have to shut it down. So for the NFL, and Jane's right, is very much, you know, the TV is where their dollars are. Baseball is a little bit different. And Ray, of course, you know that the challenge with baseball, obviously, in person, is that someone has to wake you up when the game's over.
You know what? That's not fair. That's not right, Keith. You know, although I will say this, Keith, my wife and I watched the Mets Marlins last night, and I said, honey, that, you know, there are three less fans than usual in the Miami Stadium.
Yes, and why is the Marlins filled with 12-year-olds? Like, where do these kids come from, right?
Well,
at
least there's some diversity in the crowds now behind home plate.
Well, you make a point.
So
I
can't even remember where I was at this point.
That's
but,
all right.
What's interesting, not to get too into the weeds, because everyone loves real deep engineering conversations about how sports are broadcast, the innovation that's going to come out of this, both in terms of distribution and production, are going to be pretty pronounced. And, I mean, it's stuff we're doing here in Montclair, and we're using AI cameras when we launched the sports network in partnership with our athletics department here. And I was, you know, this was a year ago when we were like, we're going to be using new kind of digital tools to tell stories and, you know, using largely social media for broadcasting and providing a bunch of on-demand stuff. Look, the Orlando and you know, the bubble, they're using all robotics. They are eliminating a lot of the impediments to kind of creative storytelling, and they're using all kinds of new distribution tools. So on the back end, you know, this is in many ways sports production or sports distribution. They're going to become a lot more like Netflix, and you probably, while they will lose dollars in the short term on gate revenue, they're certainly looking for ways in which they can maximize the amount that they are able to make on media distribution, both traditional and non-traditional, as well as figure out how to, you know, drastically reduce production costs, which had become pretty pronounced for some of these sports properties.
Jane.
I think the storytelling has suffered, like from a journalism standpoint. I think that not having access to the players in the same way that we used to is actually, I think it makes for, you know, there are fewer anecdotes, just little things that I've noticed. Like there are fewer anecdotes in some of the games that the analysts are able to throw out in some of the games that I've watched. I feel like having to go through so many different layers to get to people makes a difference. I think that people talking to you through a computer screen, it reduces the amount of intimacy and connection that can happen between people. So I think that ultimately affects the kind of storytelling that happens and the kind of pieces of information that people are willing to give. So I think the bells and whistles are kind of substituting a little bit for the heart of the storytelling we used to be able to do. And I'm concerned that if, you know, when everything quote unquote goes back to normal, or when we're able to, you know, stand in front of each other and make human connections again, that, that broadcasters will mistake the kind of the technical innovation that has come out of this as progress when really I think something's been lost.
I'll tell you, I have been so impressed, and maybe I am spoiled by having the best baseball announcing team as the team for my team, and that's the Mets. That's Gary Cohen and Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling. But these guys, yeah, it's not exactly the same, but they really haven't missed a beat. The resiliency of professionals doing their job is pretty impressive. And so I take this as a positive. And you look all around the league, you watch the MLB network in the morning. You know, there are a lot of broadcasters doing a heck of a good job under difficult circumstances. Let's go back to the phones. Tony in Schenectady. Tony, you're on.
Yeah, listen, great show. I suffer from a mental illness, and like many people who have problems like I do, and in fact, regular people, this COVID shutdown has been kind of like devastating, being cooped up in my apartment for months with literally nothing to do. And I am so looking forward to the NFL season so that I have something to look forward to. I get some excitement on the weekends. I have something to think about. And I know it sounds so silly that it's a mental health issue, that I really need to watch sports. I really need that in my life in order to give me something that's been missing for the past 6 months. And I was just hoping that maybe you could talk about that a bit. Thanks.
Thanks, Tony. Yes, and I mentioned that at the beginning of the show. I think there is a certain amount of it just feels right. When it feels like something in this world where everything is on its head is now back right side up. Keith.
So, Tony, I don't think that sounds silly at all. And, you know, I think I've told the story probably one too many times. But I think I always refer to the 1994 Rockets championship as when they won that final game against the Knicks, game seven against the Knicks, as the happiest moment of my life. And this is someone who is married and has two children. And I stick to my assessment. It was this incredible moment of joy as a Houston sports fan who had suffered through Phi Slamma Jamma and the Astros and everything and the Oilers. Right. And so I do think, look, there's a reason why we love sports so much. There's this element of relationship and of drama and of story and of, you know, attachment and you know, some of the things that sometimes make sports a bit much, but that's that joy that we get from it is very real. And there is something to be said about, you know, sports has been a big part of a lot of some of the most difficult moments in you know, the globe's history, and there's a reason for that. And so I think I do think the NFL is going to play because I think the NFL is going to find a way to play because, you know, using the cliche too big to fail, I think they're just going to find a way to play. But I don't think it's abnormal or unusual at all to in a very difficult time to find solace and joy in this thing that, you know, while we hopefully understand isn't that meaningful in the grand scheme of life, is still very meaningful in that moment.
Jane.
For me, you know, I totally sympathize with where the caller is coming from and that each of us experience these things in different ways. For me, the joys that I've had and the memories that I have from sports come from playing, you know, come from playing roller derby and scoring 99 points against Jersey Shore as a jammer one time. Or, you know, I remember stealing the ball on West 4th Street when I was playing with, you know, a bunch of guys and, you know, being called a nasty word, but doing it in a moment of victory, really. So it was all okay. But like, those are the things that I miss being able to play. And I think we miss being able to play. So even though, you know, so part of me is, you know, feels a bit cheated that we're propping up some professional sports and saying, here, have these, when we don't have a society that functions well enough to be able to allow us all to be able to play basketball or to play roller derby or soccer or whatever your sport is. And so, you know, for me, like, you know, when I've had really difficult times in my life, a lot of times playing sports has pulled me through. And so that's kind of more what I miss. And I don't think we're back to a place where we can do that yet.
Well, the bowling alleys are open again.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Finally.
Go for it.
All right,
good luck.
Let's go to Gus in Albany. Gus, go ahead.
Hi. Longtime listener, first time caller. I have a question for your guests and then a comment for Ray. Do you think the baseball playoffs are going to end up in a bubble format? And if so, do you think that might even happen in New York because it's safer here?
I love that idea. All right, quickly, we only have about a minute left. So, Keith, you go first.
Oh, boy, I don't know. I assumed we were going to end before we got to the playoffs. I just kind of naturally assumed that. But, yeah,
still.
You know, it seems entirely reasonable that that might happen because they're going to want to get to the finish line.
All right, Jane.
Bubble teams have done much better. Bubble sports are doing better. I think it actually makes a lot of sense, and if they're thinking long-term, they'll do it.
All right. Gus, you have a comment.
All right. Let's go Mets.
Oh, yeah, man. All right. Well, we have 34 games to go. We'll see what happens. All right. Now, Keith Strudler, how do we find out more about your fine work at your college?
Well, you can go to the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University and just look at all the exciting things that are happening, including a lot of transformation that's happening during the age of COVID. So I should know the website by, but go Montclair State University School of Communication and Media. Lots of fun stuff.
All right, and good luck with the 8th grade math assessments. I know it'll work out just fine. It'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll see.
Jane, how do we find out more about your work at Marist?
Marist Center for Sports Communication, same sort of thing. Just come to marist.edu, and you can look at the little bottom of the page. There's a link to the Center for Sports Communication, and you can go right there and find out about Michael Smith being an adjunct professor last semester for an interviewing class and different things like that, different projects that we're working on.
Very cool. Are you working on anything for the Daily News at the moment?
I've been doing some columns on college sports and the return of college sports. You could probably tell I have some opinions on that matter.
I think so, yes.
And I've been putting them down in writing. Those are the kinds of things that I've been doing.
Well, it was great to have you both here. I really appreciate you taking an hour and making time for us. Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, announcing that all 21 Winslow Homer paintings owned by the museum are on display through Sunday, September 6th. ArkellMuseum.org. At Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs. No contact required. Completed work within 3 weeks or less. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Well, once again, thanks to Jane McManus and Keith Strudler for joining us. Thank you for listening. Some very good calls today. Thank you to Zach, our engineer. Phones were answered by Jordan Yuxall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, it's cookies. Two local bakers who have emerged during the pandemic and started a new business, Cookie Therapy Albany. Genius! That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.